Good evening. My name is Jean-Luc Pilon, and I'm the designated curator for this particular exhibit, Ancient Treasures, Dead Sea Scrolls. I'm very pleased to see you in such great number this evening for the first of a series of 8 lectures dealing with various themes related to the exhibit. Cette série de conférences est une occasion rêvée pour des Canadiens d'apprendre du rôle qu'une meilleure connaissance de l'ancienne histoire peut jouer dans nos vies et comment celles-ci peuvent enrichir nos valeurs en nous offrant une meilleure compréhension des contextes historiques, sociaux et politiques qui ont façonné les temps bibliques dans les Saintes Terres. Since the inauguration of the exhibit on the 5th of December last, tens of thousands of visitors have filed past the various displays in the gallery. It's quite clear that people are keen to learn more as to the roots of their Judeo-Christian roots, whether they are Jewish, Christian, Muslim or other. Il y a une véritable soif de prendre contact avec ces objets qui témoignent à notre ancien passé et qui sont au cœur du développement de la société occidentale. En même temps, nous reconnaissons que ces objets, ces artefacts sont muets sans un examen déterminé, silencieux, systématique, mais poussé par les érudits qui peuvent souffler une vie. As well, this evening's lecture, as well as the others, which can be heard any Thursday during February and March, will allow us to acknowledge that Canadians have participated and continue to participate in this process of discovery and revelation of the mysteries of our ancient times. For nearly 50 years, individuals and Canadian institutions have discreetly participated in this great quest for knowledge of ancient history in the Holy Land. Il y a plus d'une décennie maintenant que les manuscrits de la Mer Morte ont été publiés. Cependant, le mystère qui entoure ces documents et qui sera toujours associé à ces manuscrits continue à alimenter et contribue à un fond de savoir et d'écrit croissant au plan populaire et savant. Ça ne veut pas dire qu'elles sont interprétées. Le travail d'interprétation va occuper toute une autre génération. Ce soir, nous sommes privilégiés d'entendre le professeur Jean Duhem de la Faculté de théologie à l'Université de Montréal. Sa formation particulière est dans le domaine des études religieuses, la sociologie et l'enseignement. Il détient plusieurs diplômes de l'Université de Montréal, l'Université de Québec à Chicoutimi et l'École biblique et archéologique française de Jérusalem. Professor Duhem's area of expertise includes the Psalms, the Prophets, and the learned writings. Notwithstanding his inquiry on these aspects of biblical history, Dr. Duhem has been able to transfer his knowledge of these sects into our contemporary Canadian context. Professor Duhem enseigne les études bibliques et religieuses au niveau collégial et universitaire. Sa liste de publications est très longue et ses contributions sur divers aspects des manuscrits de la Mer Morte. This evening, Professor Duhem will help us to better appreciate the meaning of these 3 scroll fragments which are exhibited at the other end of the hall here, just nearby. Il donnera vie à ces mots rédigés il y a plus de 2000 ans et nous aidera à comprendre comment la découverte de ces écrits peut enrichir nos valeurs. Without any further ado, here is our guest speaker tonight, Professor Jean Duhem, University of Montreal, who will speak to us on the meaning of the scrolls. Thank you very much. Well, as I've just been introduced, I'm going to talk about the meaning of the Dead Sea Scrolls. I've put the first page of the Community Rule Scroll up on the screen. If you've seen the exhibit already, you may recognize this particular scroll. But we're going to examine it a bit more closely. I have about 30 so slides that I'm going to present to you and discuss with you. We'll take a look at the three scroll fragments that are here at the exhibit, which were among some of the first to be discovered in 1947. Discovered in Qumran, there's an excerpt from the book of Isaiah. The quotation that you see here deals with a number. It's number 1 to 11. And there are 11 grottos or caves in which we found these. It tells you Q for Qumran, and then the abbreviation IS for Isaiah. B means that it's the second, it's a beta version of the scrolls found in this area. And this is the same format we use to identify all of these scrolls. Found in the first cave, S, from Serek, it's a Hebrew word, it's rule, if you will, in English. So we've kept the war scroll, which we'll also find in the exhibit, Milchama in Hebrew. So 1QMC is the war scroll. Now, before talking about these three scrolls, I'd like to review quite quickly the actual archaeological site. We'll talk about the caves as well, and some of the ruins, and the community as such. For each of the documents, I'll try to summarize the history of its discovery, its characteristics, an overview of its content with a few examples, a few specific concrete examples. I think it's really important to actually read the text itself. And then perhaps I'll conclude by giving you some of my thoughts on its significance and meaning. The archaeological site of Qumran is indicated here with the arrow on the slide. It's located north west of the Dead Sea, 15 kilometers or so south of Jericho, approximately 20 kilometers east of Jerusalem, southwest if you wish, and with a certain difference in altitude. 800 meters is the altitude of Jerusalem, and the Dead Sea, of course, is 400 meters below the actual sea level. So there's a considerable drop in altitude here. So there's a bit of a plateau where we find Qumran, almost a kilometer above the height of the Dead Sea, 1,200 meters. Site that's well known is Ein Gedi, 30 kilometers north of this site. You'll see on the following slide the Masada site, which is further south of the Dead Sea. So that's the geographic location. It's rather isolated, desert area. We find water is only rainwater, and it doesn't rain that often, perhaps only 1 week out of the year. There's also a spring, which is a little bit south of the site. On this slide, you can see quite clearly the Dead Sea in the background, the hills of Jordan on the other side, and the Dead Sea at the Qumran time was higher than this. It was probably quite close to where you see this road, but it has receded since then. The plateau where Qumran is to be found is a seabed, in fact, a hundred meters higher than the actual level of the Dead Sea. The ruins that we'll look at a little bit closer in a moment are here. We found scrolls in the cliffs here, and in another area approximately here where you see the spot. Now, as for the ruins, if we take a look at them a little bit more closely now, it disappeared in the world of the Bible. This is an excellent, excellent layout here. But the ruins themselves now were searched from 1951 to 56. An archaeological dig was in progress at that time. Well, it gives you an idea. The first were discovered in 47, so it took a little bit of time to organize a proper archaeological expedition. They weren't found while we were doing the expedition. They were found prior to that by curious Bedouins, for the most part. It was Father Roland Deveau, a Jesuit from Jerusalem, who took charge of the archaeological work, together with the Department of Antiquities of Jordan. Professor Harding, and the reason for which It was the Bible, the Biblical Institute in the Jordanian state, is that this was very shortly after the War of Independence of Israel, and the Jordanian Jordanians controlled the geography. This is one of the issues here. There's all this political conflict and ferment, which, with perhaps very few exceptions, except for Jewish archaeologists, were not integrated into the archaeological site nor in the publication of the scrolls until much, much later on. Why? Because the area, geographic area, was on the Jordanian side of the border, and they were kept there until 1957, at which time the Israelis gained control of all of Jerusalem, including the part in which the museum was found. Now, that's a digression, and we will be here till tomorrow if I continue in that light. But, okay, 51 to 56, archaeological dig under the control of Father Devaux, at various levels of occupation, which doesn't give us too much, but it's interesting to note that it was Israeli for a while. It was a military outpost of the Romans at the 8th BCE. We find pottery shards in the plastering of the well, 8th century BCE. It's very easy to date once you have ceramic shards. And then we have the basis of this square tower, a Roman fort, if you will, and part of the walls. It's a very square building, very, very clearly square, and it will be the most stable part of Qumran for many, many years. Then this settlement was inhabited by a community towards the end of the second century BCE, 130 BCE. A new group occupied Qumran up until approximately 31 BCE. Perhaps even a little later, perhaps even to the edge of our common era. So on the edges of this Israeli fort, they used it as a base, if you will. They used this square building, and they also expanded it to meet their needs. Twice, in fact, and we can distinguish 1A and period 1B. Period 1B is the one that we have here at that time. And what we see quite clearly on this sketch is a whole network of aqueducts, or there is a catch basin here, which might have been used to filter some of the surface runoff, and then there's a cistern around one here. We found the walls. It's linked to two others by a little canal or channel. Two more here, and further ones here, here, and here. There's another water-bearing canal, an aqueduct, which of course is linked in here, and the two join here. So a water works, which is rather significant. They come from the Wadi, the runoff river or stream in the rainy season. It's a very brief rainy season, but the waterway, the creek bed, will engorge, and it's complete flood for a while. But Qumran, of course, had even to establish a dam to capture the runoff water and channel it into their system of cisterns, which was probably covered and would satisfy their needs for about a year. We see some major rooms, or there's a refectory. It's a mess hall, in other words, probably oblong. And adjacent to that, we found a series of cooking pots and utensils. There's a few shards here. There's some bowls, some plates, some goblets. There's about 1,000 pieces of dinnerware, as it were. We estimated from the size of this hall, there might have been 200 persons accommodated in this refectory, but some archaeologists contend that it might be 50 to 75, but then there is a little bit of a neighborhood. We have other pottery shards. There's a potter, he has a wheel and two kilns, and at strategic points throughout these two basins here, probably, but we're not quite sure, would lead off to the potter's There are ritual baths which serve for purification rites as required by law, by ritual law. There may be as many as 10 people could be accommodated here. The last structure is this one. It's a room which was found, or vestiges of the room. It's not what's on the ground floor, it's what was on the upper floor, which is important. And in the ruins of this, we found the ceiling of the main floor, which is in fact the floor of the second floor. We found two very large tables, approximately 2 meters in length, with benches, well, approximately the same length, but lower, of course, joined to the table. We found three ink wells, in one of which we found vegetable ink, black, corresponding in all its characteristics to the ink that was used on the scrolls. So this is a concrete link between this archaeological site and the scrolls. Absolutely no manuscripts or scrolls were found in these ruins at this site, but they were found always in caves and jars, etc. This room, as Père Devaux was a Dominican priest, the monastic tradition knows very well what it is to copy and scribe these manuscripts. So it was called a scriptorium. Now, as to the caves, in Qumran, 11 caves were discovered, first one by Bedouins, but Père Devaux and his team, 51 to 56, did 300 surveys in the cliffside and on the terrace, the seabed plateau here. And you can see the geographical markings here giving you the inclination. It's quite stiff cliff. 40 caves were found. Some had been habitable and habitated, but maybe 2,000 years before BCE. Now, those that are of interest to us during period 1A and 1B of Qumran, there are 26 caves which correspond to this point in time. 11 contained scrolls, and they're numbered here. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 1, 2, 3, 6, and 11 are in the cliffside. 2, 3, 11, 6 are here. Now, cave 4, 5, and 7 through 10 are on the plateau. In other words, in what used to be the seabed of the Dead Sea. I didn't talk about periods 2 and periods 3, so without going back to my former slide, I'll just talk you through it. The population that was there during part 1A, 1B, saw a catastrophe, an earthquake, in fact, in about 30 BCE. And this is recounted by Josephus, a historian at the time. There's a wide chasm, 50 centimeters, that covers the entire length of the site. So this same bunch of inhabitants abandoned the site at about that time, perhaps a little later, but they reoccupied the site as of approximately 4 BCE, using the parts of the site which were not damaged by the earthquake. One of the major cisterns was broken in half, so it was filled in, it was backfilled, and that was used as a yard in which other activities could take place. They rechanneled the conduits for the water and the aqueducts, so they had to be diverted, etc. The site remained occupied by the second group until 68 CE, Common Era. It was the same area that was seized by a Roman legion coming from Jericho. Flavius Josephus, the historian, wrote quite detailed comment about the activities of this legion. And in June 68, the Roman troops took the site of Qumran, and its original inhabitants disappeared or were killed. And it's probably at this time that the scrolls were hidden to avoid capture by the Romans. Then there was period 3, 68 to 73 CE. Once again, we find Roman coins, various artifacts on the site which attest to this fact. Now, as to the archaeological works and the caves, after the main work done by DeVoe and his team, 51-56, there were other expeditions mounted to confirm the basic interpretation as sketched by DeVoe and his team. One point discussed at the time was to try to establish a link between this site at Qumran and the various caves. In 1995-96, we found ancient pathways, footpaths, from the ruins to the caves, and we found brads from sandals and various objects which, in fact, offered concrete evidence that there was a connection between the caves and the community in a regular way. Now, in the lot of scrolls found, we have thousands, and at Qumran, there are thousands and thousands of fragments. There are fragments of 900 scrolls. Here, this is Cave 1. The original entryway was probably this one. Our first discovery, was here, in fact, through here, apparently by two Bedouin shepherds who went into the cave. Perhaps they were throwing rocks to chase any wild animals or find a goat, and they heard the sound of breaking pottery. That's one version. And the other version was they were target practicing, and there's another one who was saying they were looking for a cache, a place to hide contraband. So it doesn't matter. Pick your own mythology. But anyway, it was discovered by a young Bedouin, Mohammed Adib. We have a picture we'll show you later. He discovered this cave, and he found a dozen or so jars, and in some of these jars found ancient scrolls, which he, of course, brought back to the Bethlehem area. And they ended up on the antiquities market, and voila, Qumran has been discovered. Now, 225 are biblical texts, scrolls of all the Bible, Tophilin, which are tiny little articles that the Jewish sect will wear on their heads or on their wrists. So we have fragments of the entire Hebrew Bible, the traditional Old Testament, except for the book of Esther. We don't know why. We don't have any fragments of that. There are two possible explanations. One is that it disappeared. It was eaten by the mice. They've eaten others. Why not that one? But the other possible explanation was that the book of Esther justifies the feast of Purim. And Purim was not part of the Qumran settlement for that particular community. So it didn't have any particular pertinence to their ritual, cult, or ceremony. Now, there are the two canonical texts which are preserved in the Christian Bible, in what we call the Old Testament, but which were not preserved in the Pentateuch or the Protestant versions of the Bible. These two books were sometimes in Hebrew, sometimes transcribed in Greek, and they circulated in the Jewish community, probably during the diaspora at Palestine, at Alexandria, and served to the first Christians in their sect when they were spreading the word, spreading the good news among the Jews of the diaspora using these. So the Christians did, in fact, preserve these two books, whereas a Protestant tradition set them aside in the 14th century, coming back to the Hebrew version of the Bible, the Word of God, making sure that we had the right word. In other words, they set aside anything which was doubtful. Now, we have fragments, of course, of these. You see Sir, Ben Sira, that's the abbreviation used here. We know that this was composed in Hebrew. We have fragments from Qumran, but we also have some in Greek, in Syriac, in Armenac. We also have fragments of pseudo-epigraphs. Pseudo-epigraphs are those texts which were done, were sponsored, if you will, by great personages, and they're marginal notes of the Bible, Chapter 5 of Genesis, there's the patriarch Enoch, who was just and righteous, walking in the light of the Lord, and he was taken up into heaven. Now, we don't know what became of him. The Jewish tradition says, well, why did he go to heaven? What is he doing there? Why? And would he have something to tell us today? In Jewish tradition, as of the 3rd century BCE, books were circulated about the subject of Enoch, describing what he saw in heaven. So he got a free tour of the cosmos, thanks to God. He didn't need a spirit or an opportunity or a Mars lander. He had a direct pipeline to God. And he saw the creation from God's perspective, you know, from way up there. And God also let him see behind the curtain of time, both past and future. He'll see the reward of the just and the punishment of the evil, and he brought back this knowledge to try to incite his fellows to live the righteous life. Now, this is Judaic tradition. It wasn't integrated into the Bible, but we do find versions, like versions, in Ethiopian bodies of lore, in Armenian as well, and in various. We found fragments of these at Qumran. And the biggest batch of scrolls, 600 scrolls, non-biblical, unknown before the discovery of Qumran. I'll give you the types only. There are rules, community rule scroll, for example. There are legal texts. There's eschatological texts, the war scroll, for example. The war, this is the war at the end of time, for example. This is the conflict, the ultimate conflict between the forces of light and the forces of dark, between good and evil. There's exegesis. In other words, interpretive texts of the Bible trying to extract meaning. These are called pesharim, pesher in the singular, which are commentary. There's one for the book of Habakkuk. The prophet Habakkuk announces his vision. And apparently during the life of the Quram community, saying that this event corresponds to this in our time, as we often do in some milieu, if we can prove that the events forecast or predicted by the seer or prophet have in fact been true or come to light, then we can have a greater credibility for his prophecies of the future. Then further, there's a parapublic literature, comments on the Bible in a general sense, paraphrases of Genesis, for example, alternate versions which embroider it a bit. There's some poetry, the dim scroll, the prayers, of course, and their identity, their sense of self is also found in the prayers, liturgical texts. There are chants for the Shabbat, Sabbath, taking inspiration for the temple in Jerusalem, of course, but developed in parallel to the conventional or orthodox Judaic rite. There's esoteric scrolls dealing with calendars and time. And somewhat in an astrological sense, they describe one or two persons, in a very elegant way, a very brilliant way. This individual has seven parts of light and two parts of darkness. So that's nine months of pregnancy, very likely. But there's another personality, a very ugly personality, who has exactly the opposite composition, seven dark and two light. Very bizarre, very esoteric, very strange. And then there's the copper scroll, which gives a list of 60 or so areas where are to be found treasure troves. None have ever been found, but perhaps this is the impression or the portion or the tithe that one would give to the temple, but was held back all the while awaiting that there had been some staff turnover at the temple, legitimate priests in the eyes of this particular cult at Qumran, who felt that the priests, the leadership of the temple, was not worthy. So what did we learn about the community at Qumran? First of all, there is a link between the scrolls and the ruins of the buildings here. We talked about the scriptorium. The pottery also was fabricated in Qumran, the ones that are found, the jars that are found in the caves. It refers to a specific religious sect. They probably lived here, but it seems self-evident, but it has been contested. And according to the text, we deal with a group of priests and lay persons who are in disagreement, in revolt, in protest against the temple in Jerusalem. They have a particularly strict interpretation of the law of Moses, dualism, of course, lightness versus the dark, the good versus the bad, a very dualistic interpretation of the universe and cosmos. They're awaiting the Messiah, of course. Or perhaps even two, a priest and a king, who will reestablish and restore the institutions of the past. And they are also awaiting the apocalypse, the war to end all wars, the war at the end of time. These are probably related to the Essenes. And who were the Essenes? The Essenes were, in fact, a religious sect described by Josephus, Flavius Josephus, in his writings. It corresponds very well. The description that Josephus makes of the Essenes and the things that we have discovered at Qumran lead us to believe that it's one and the same settlement or this one and the same community. Others believe that because of its very holy character, it might have been a very reactionary group, going back to the time of the Sadducees, for example. A very archaic form of Judaism, a proto-form, which had sort of developed and evolved on its own track, retaining the old belief. Now, I'll come back to the three scrolls that we have here. In the book of Isaiah, it was discovered in 1947 by Bedouins. The two Bedouins that are associated to this discovery are the man with the mustache on the right, Mohammed Abdib, or Mohammed the Wolf. That's the one about the three versions there. The one in the middle is the Isaiah scroll before it was unrolled or opened, if you will. It was a heck of a challenge, mind you. Look at it. And the one on the right is Professor Sukinik, from the Hebrew University of Jerusalem, who, at the risk of his very life, took a bus in Arab territory, disguised as an Arab, to buy these on the black market in Jerusalem. He opened the scroll, he unrolled it. At the time, we would place them between two sheets of glass, and he's working on the text at this point in that photo. We also found in Qumran, in Cave 1, a few fragments which come and complete this scroll, the missing pieces of the jigsaw, as it were, which of course is further evidence that the scroll initially was, or at one time, was hidden in that particular cave. There are four sheets, and when I say sheets, I mean there are four hides of vellum, usually goat hides, and we can date the writing on them depending on its style. So this is from the time of Herod, the reign of Herod, so the last half of the century before the Common Era. So this is page one, if you will. We have it here at the museum. Page two is in Montreal, the second one here for our exhibition this summer. And if you roll it on itself, the scroll, you can see where it had systematically been destroyed, eaten away, eroded. You can see where it had been damaged. Page three, page four. Now in this text, Isaiah, we can see how it's presented. These are infrared pictures. You can see the margins, you can see the columns. You have margins at the top, you have columns that separate, that are separated by margin. And for the entirety of this text, there's very little variability between the Isaiah text and this scroll and the classic, conventional, biblical text that we have today. It's almost Well, this is a reproduction of a text that was 1,000 years. There's 1,000 years between the two copies, and yet the text itself is literally almost identical. First of all, people find that it's very poorly lit, it's very dark, it's been darkened with time, it's tarnished. Infrared photography, of course, gives us many advantages, so we can really sharpen the picture. The second part of the book of Isaiah, chapter 40 onwards, is 66 chapters. It's one of the longest ones of the Bible, Isaiah. This part was composed in the middle of the 6th century B.C., B.E. rather, the period of exile of the population of Judea, deported to Babylon, and towards the end of this epoch, where it was Cyrus the Great, a prophet announced on behalf of God, of course, that the servitude of his people is coming to an end, that Jerusalem would be rebuilt, the temple would be refounded, etc. Now, with this announcement, we find the word servant, and some call him Messiah or Jesus, and this was recognized by Jacob. Now, two extracts of this manuscript, and this, of course, is an enlargement of the first part of the text. As you can see, it's quite legible when it's expanded like this, it's magnified, and it's photographed with infrared. For those who can read Hebrew, the arrow points to beginning. It's a Masoteric text. The rabbis had developed a system where the vowels were not indicated here. Well, you have an almost identical text in modern Hebrew below, and you can almost read it here. Fear not, you Israel, my servant Jacob, whom I have chosen, offspring of Abraham, my friend, you whom I have taken from the ends of the earth and summoned from its far-off places, you whom I have called my servant, who I have chosen and will not cast off, fear not, I am with you. Be not dismayed. For I am your God, I will strengthen you and help you and uphold you with my right hand of justice. So God is telling his people, fear not, I haven't rejected you, don't feel slighted, I'm still here to help you. The two texts are almost identical, perhaps with a little cross T or dotted I here or there. The other segment, Isaiah 43, there's a few variations between the scroll version and the modern version, the biblical version. Here the verb to say, to speak, Amar, Omer, fear not, for I am with you. From the east I will bring back your descendants. From the west I will gather you. I will say to the north. In Hebrew, I will say, the word say. We have three consonants only in the conventional text. In the scroll, you have four. The second consonant, it's a vav. It's a long O. Now, the rabbinic style will indicate that it will only have a little dot over the first letter, or you will still write it with the little bar, the vav, with a dot or a point above it. Now, this is strictly a spelling convention. There are other variations which are quite interesting. And further in the text, I will say to the north, give them up, and to the south, hold them not back. Bring back my sons from afar, and my daughters from the ends of the earth. In the Isaiah text, as we have it today, God addresses him to the north and to the south. In other words, to the authorities, the civil authorities. Give them up. Free them. Give them up. Don't hold back. And hold not back. Bring back my sons from afar and my daughters from the ends of the earth. God continues to talk to the authorities in north and south. Now, in the Qumran texts, after hold not back, it stops there, and then he says, bring back your sons from afar and your daughters from the ends of the earth. Not mine, but yours. So it's a different interpretation, a different way of reading the text. In other words, he's no longer addressing the authorities to free these people. He's telling the people to assist and help. Very minimal changes, but it perhaps gives us some light as to how these texts were interpreted, even sometimes when it was a little bit ambiguous. I'll pick up the pace here. An important witness to the transmission of this text from the Mesoteric form, that is, before it was definitely set down on paper as we have it today. There are 20 or so other scrolls from Qumran which present various little variations like this, but which are very faithful, all in all, versions. There's one that's a little bit more recent that shows the definitive text of the Hebraic Bible, as it were. There are some of the comments and some of the quotations in Qumran which indicate the significance and importance of Isaiah, the book of Isaiah. Which brings us to the second that we have, the second scroll here. At the here's the jars in which it was found. Patriarch Samuel was the purchaser of this scroll, and he tried to sell it when he saw that it didn't have very much interest for his library. He tried to perhaps make a few bucks on it. He couldn't sell it, so he put ads in 1955 in the Wall Street Journal, biblical manuscript dating back to at least 200 BC are for sale. Now, you could buy these manuscripts. It makes an excellent gift for a museum, a school, a temple, a church, whatever. So, there you are. Yigal Yadin, who was in the States, of course, saw the ad and did some fundraising for the Israel Museum and bought it through a third party. It was brought to the American Archaeological School, or American School of Oriental Research in Jerusalem, or other, and photographed by two Americans. The photos that we have today, the first series here, there might be more recent ones, but you have the complete manuscript here. 11 columns, you saw the first page, it was my showpiece at the beginning, and the other columns right to the end. We have the end of this text, and on the same scroll, the same roll as it were, we had two other shorter texts. What does this contain? It contains a community rule. In other words, an exhortation to come back to the law of Moses, give themselves over to it, practice religion in a more religious fashion, more rigorous fashion, more precise fashion, revealed to the son of Sadok. They will depend on the teachings of a certain number of priests who have a very peculiar, unique interpretation of the Mosaic, the Moses text, the Law of Moses, so that they could live their lives in a much more fulsome and righteous way. It's a very straightforward presentation. There's a description of the goals and objectives of the community. There is an initiation rite, which is called the Alliance of Israel. Then there's long instructions on the two spirits, the two dialectically opposed spirits, the dark and the light, of course. There's a number of rules for the organization of daily life. There's a program for a new community, a utopic view, if you will, but it could be a throwback to an earlier format. So what we have here exhibited at the museum are the seven first columns. I've put them in two rows here, in two pieces, but here you can see it of a piece, left to right. There's a cover page, there's a few stitches, as you can see, from time to time, including here. We also see, if you have a very good eye, the margins. They're not too difficult to see. There's breakdown into paragraphs, and this is, if you can see the red spot, there are even a few brackets in the margins to show, indicate the subdivisions, as it were. The first scribes, the first translators of these texts more or less ignored these. So it gives you an idea on how they divided the text up for working purposes. We also see that there's been some corrections and additions. It's been annotated, corrected, amended from time to time to time to time again. And it's quite fascinating to see that we're in the presence of a text which was copied over 2,000 years ago, 2,000 years ago, by some perhaps some young scribe or perhaps a veteran who might have been maybe 30. And of course, he was quite sure that he was on the right path, and he was doing this correction for very righteous purposes. Entering the covenant community, here's the last column here. There's a bit of a paragraph, a bit like what we do with a computer today. And it reads, well, then the priest shall report God's righteousness along with its wondrous works, and recount all his merciful acts of love towards us, towards love, towards Israel. And then the Levites are the priests, in other words, shall enumerate the iniquities of the sons of Israel and all the guilty transgressions and their sins. And all the transgressions and their sins during the domination of Belial. Belial, the name means the good for nothing. In other words, the head devil. He becomes Satan, of course, in Christian tradition, but he's the head honcho of the forces of evil. But you know, he's a no good nick. And all those who cross over into the covenant, who want to renew their vows perhaps annually, shall confess after them the priests, by saying, we have perverted ourselves, we have rebelled, we have sinned, we have, and our fathers before us. So we're coming back to the law of Moses in a very integral fashion. This was the sense of this community. I'll give you another extract of instructions on the two spirits, the good and the bad, of course, the evil, the light, the dark. You'll see an echo of this in Genesis, when God created mankind in the form of man and woman, etc. And this is what we found on line 17, approximately. He created humanity so that it might dominate the world. And then there's something we don't find in the Bible. Two spirits and who will continue to walk until his visit. Perversity and perversion, the source of light, truth, in other words, and the sources of darkness or perversity. So on the one hand, we have the Prince of Light, the angel of heaven, of right, of righteousness, which is perhaps the Archangel Michael between you and me, and the dominating the sons of justice, and then the angel of darkness, which is Belial, of course, or Satan, or Beelzebub, call him what you may. So choose your path. Further in the text, the forces of light and darkness fight not only in the cosmos, but they fight in each person's heart or soul or interior or mind or psyche, trying to pull you one way and the other, either to the gulf of darkness where you will be damned to perdition. Now, there's column 6 here. We can compare the lifestyle of this community what Flavius Josephus describes of the Essenes. And this is the passages that we use to compare. It gives you a bit of an idea. Together they will eat, together they will bathe, together they will take advice in all those areas where there are 10 gathered. You need 10 to pray, even today in Jewish tradition. There must not be lacking among them a man who is a priest. And each member shall sit according to his rank before him. In other words, according to his rank. And they shall be asked for their counsel concerning every matter. When the table has been prepared for eating, or the new wine for drinking, bread and wine, we find this again repeated in the Jewish tradition and again in the Christian tradition. The priest shall be the first to stretch out his hand in order to bless the first, the bread, the blessing of the bread. And I've put in yellow here, highlighted on the screen, which we might find a doublet to describe. In fact, skipped over a word, which is repeated here again. It was already there. He came back to the first word at 20, and he retranscribed this entire sequence once again. It's rather interesting, and it wasn't corrected by the head scribe, I guess, or the reviser, the senior guy in the office here at the scriptorium. He let it go by, or he didn't notice it. So the text is there with this this fault or this flaw. And so continually each man that will be looking at the Torah, And the many, and they call themselves that, the many, shall spend the third part of every night of the year reading the book, the Torah, studying judgment and in unity, saying benedictions. So you see what the ideals were of this community. This is one of the most important texts dealing with the community life of Qumran. Josephus Flavius, in describing the Essenes, describes something extremely similar. So we feel that he's probably describing the Essenes. There are 10 copies of this text. This one is the most interesting because it shows you an evolution, revisions, amendments of versions, one to the other, to the other. The others were always saved, of course, by way of reference text, you know, archival material, even then. So two other documents were submitted. They're also rules, but they're rules for in times of famine, which brings us to this, the time of the war of the end, which brings us to the war scroll. Here it is, before being opened or unrolled with a few fragments on the outside, the jars in which it was found, next to, this is a jar of period two, Qumran. This bearded fellow here with the beret and the beard is Father Devaux, the archaeological chef de mission, as it were. And if I'd shown you the entire picture, you'd see that he's discussing Yel Hadin, the son of the purchaser of these scrolls. Yadin is the individual who made the best comment on the scroll here. Now, this is what I find described a little bit below. A few fragments were found in Cave 1, which indicates a further link that this scroll comes from the community of Qumran. We have the entire manuscript here, except for one column which has come loose and a few fragments. But we have the beginning with its cover page and 18 columns which are seen here. There was a 19th and perhaps even a 20th, because there seems to be a margin, a space for a margin after the 19th column. So there's two letters, there's a beginning of the next something and a fragment. So 20, perhaps 21. We have the top, but we don't have the bottom of this manuscript or this scroll. And you can see how it's divided here. And you can see how it is compared with the contemporary one of Isaiah. There's an introduction, inspired somewhat on the book of Daniel, giving you the war at the end of time, how it will occur, etc. And then there's a series of instructions on how to prepare, a tactical advice. Then there is a grouping of prayers for times of war. And then there are war tales or war stories. Now, it's not the detail of the battles, but it's rather the pep talk. This is the exhortations to battle. This is the motivational speeches that the leadership gives to the troops. And it's more or less like the chaplaincy book. It's really a chaplain's missile, as it were. You have to say the prayers at the right time, and you have to choose the appropriate sermon for the circumstances. We have columns 11 through 14 on exhibit here at the museum. Here they are. Essentially, these are prayers of war in three groups. Prayers to be recited at camp on the eve of battle. This is the vigil, as it were. Then there are prayers to be said on the field of battle itself, where you curse the enemy and you draw down God's assistance to yourself, and prayers of victory, of course, and prayers of thanks and prayers of joy. Column 15, the text begins at the bottom of 14. It gives a description of some of the engagements, the battles. I've given you three that I'd like to deal with you very briefly here. It's quite interesting, column 11. It's the first one that you see here at the museum. It's a text referring to the example of the battle between David and Goliath. And you have one of the very last of the mosaics that you see here on exhibit is David, of course, with the weapons and Goliath face to face, as it were. So on the eve of combat, we remind God how he gave David strength to defeat Goliath. He came to fight him with the righteous name of God and not a spear. And it reads like this. For those who can read Hebrew, go right to it. Goliath from Gath, gallant giant, you delivered into the hands of David your servant, for he trusted in your powerful name and not in a sword or spear. For the battle is yours. You decide on war, you know, if God picks the winner before the battle begins, and it's all for naught in any case. And then you have a hymn to be recited on the field of battle, where we come forward as the veritable people of God, assisted by heaven itself. So on 10, 11, 12, you still find the Prince of Light here. Now there's a little bit of words missing here, but all the angels will fight for battle. And Belial, by your hand, you saved us many times. Belial cast into the darkness, and his counsel wants us to do evil under the powers of the dark. And we are the clan of truth under the Prince of Light. Assist us and the angels of justice, all the spirits of truth under your dominion. God will fight for us, by us, with us, and we are those who continue with the work of God. That's the style of the thing. And a few lines from the description of the very last battle. And this is a little bit based on the book of Daniel. Some is almost verbatim. For this will be a time of suffering for Israel, and a service of war against all nations. For God's lot, there will be everlasting redemption and destruction for all the wicked nations. All those who are ready for war shall go and camp opposite the king of the Kitzim. Kitzim designates populations that came probably from Cyprus. But it's a code word to describe the Greeks. The Greeks who dominate the Palestinian Judean area for about two centuries and a half. And then the Romans seized power. The name is transferred to the Romans, the symbolic name of Kittim. So the Kittim is the enemy. It's the other guys, the bad guys, the black hats. And Kittim is a generalized term. And opposite all the army of Belial assembled with him on the day of vengeance by God's sword. It's God's sword that's at work here, not ours. So what do we find in this document then? In brief, we have the dualism of the war to end all wars. We also have Greco-Roman illusions here. There's probably tactical counsel that was taken from the Greek or the Romans. And it's probably pre-sectarian, adapted to their needs. We also have several other examples and related texts, but we think that this document was probably used to justify the separation of this sect, its the segregation, to sustain its objectives, perhaps even to mobilize them against the Romans in the great uprising of 66. I could close with a little plug for a book that I've translated on Judaism, on historic or ancient Judaism. These scrolls are a window on that world. They tell us about the transmission of biblical texts before the fall of Jerusalem. And this is extremely important, because after the fall of Jerusalem, the rabbis will standardize biblical texts. So we have a view on what the texts were, with a certain variety before it was standardized, perhaps homogenized or harmonized. We also notice that among the various groups, not all groups are sectarian, not all texts are sectarians. Many of the texts are shared by any number of sects within Judaism. And you're invited to take a look at libraries of a group that became a minority sect. And it's quite interesting to see that a large number of the texts are held in common by a large number of sects. It was a period of transition during an obscure period of Judaism. It was the end of that period where we're drafting the texts of the Bible, as it were, 100-150 BCE, before it solidifies, before it gels, and before we have that that conversion to the after the fall of the of Jerusalem. And it's in this context of Judaism that we find Christianity appearing as a sect. They have 35, 36 texts which deal with the messianic expectations of the group, of this Qumran group. They're not looking for one Messiah, but two, a king and a Messiah who will re-establish the old way, the best way. In fact, we find common roots with the Christian tradition here. It's a veritable gold mine of information. The corpus has been published entirely, but we haven't interpreted it all. We haven't even begun to scratch the surface of our understanding. I thank you very much for your attention, and if you have another opportunity to see them here or elsewhere, please do so. Thank you. Well, first of all, thank you very much for this lecture, fascinating as it was. I often speak with young people. I talk to them about archaeology, ancient history, and what they say. Boy, is that ever boring. Oh, it's boring. Now, if they had the opportunity to hear you speak, sir, I think that you would really, really get their attention because you've opened my eyes. I felt the excitement. I felt the tension in the room rise as you spoke. We have the time for perhaps one or two very brief questions, if you make them quite succinct, before you all want to rush off and take another look at the scrolls, I'm sure. So if you have a question or two, we could take them now, but please approach a microphone. Yes, we're into the forces of darkness here, which are being scattered a bit there, a bit more light. Thank you very much, Professor.